Hello friends, this is our last episode of Australian True Crime for 2018. We're going to take a short break for about a month, but patrons can look forward to some crime-themed Christmas presents all throughout the festive season, including updates on the scandal sweeping the Piranha Task Force. That's of course the group of Victorian police who took down some of the biggest names in the Melbourne gang wars. Some of those convictions are under threat now, would you believe? So we need to keep checking in and seeing what is going on there. And I'll be checking in with some of the biggest names in Victorian policing, such as beautiful Ron Eddles, the big man. Let's see what he makes of it all. We'll be back at full tilt on January 24, but if you can't live without your regular true crime fix until then, just go to patreon.com/austtruecrimepod, that's A-U-S-T, True Crime Pod, and sign up for the $5 a month option, and we'll keep the extra episodes coming. I promise you, there'll be something each week for you patrons. Okay, on with the show. Please be advised this podcast contains content of a graphic, violent nature. It's not appropriate for children.
This is Australian True Crime with Michelle Laurie and Emily Webb.
My goodness, it's been a massive week for Australian True Crime podcasts. As I'm recording this, news has just broken of the arrest of Chris Dawson. Emily just texted me. I've got shivers saying it to you now. It's incredible. Chris Dawson has been arrested for the murder of his wife, Lynn Dawson, in Sydney 37 years ago. Of course, so many of us around the world have been praying for this day, thanks to the work of the team behind the Teacher's Pet podcast, led by journalist Hedley Thomas. Congratulations to you guys, and of course to the family of Lynn Dawson. And this news comes just days after the Victorian coroner announced that he'd be conducting a second inquest into the murder of Melbourne bookshop owner Maria James, 38 years after the event. And that's the subject of the ABC podcast, Trace, hosted by journalist Rachel Brown. Congratulations to Rachel's team and, of course, to Maria's family. In our last Australian True Crime episode for 2018, I spoke to Rachel yesterday. She's understandably emotional about the latest development in this podcast project.
A colleague of mine sent me this thing about true crime and stats and what people want out of true crime, and it's like top is usually resolution. Mm-hmm. And that's been all the nasty, you know, why haven't you kept us informed about what's going on? And so I hope this gives them some kind of resolution, because I always said, well, I can't write you an ending.
No.
That's not my job. That's police's job or the coroner's job. So I hope this is resolution in a way.
Yeah, but then I mean,
them and the brothers, obviously.
I think at the same time, if it's an unsolved crime, you know, what can you do?
Yeah, there was this hilarious email that I got about, oh, I really thought given the all the it's in the book. I really thought given all the attention when this first came to light that you would have done more or you would have filled this in more on what's being done to solve the case.
Yeah.
And you just, he said, we haven't heard anything from you. And I'm like, oh, I don't answer to you. I'm trying to go away.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. You can't, it never ceases to amaze me how rude people can be sometimes for this thing that they are enjoying for free.
Yeah.
Really?
It's not entertainment. That's someone's mum's
death. Yeah, absolutely. And you got incredible leads from the public. Most of your listeners were loving it, had a great attitude about it, and so many people got involved. And by the way, the book I am reading, I'm halfway through, and I did think initially, oh, I think I know the story, but I'll start reading, and it's still so enjoyable. There's much extra.
Yeah.
It's definitely worth reading as well as listening to the podcast.
So I think the book pays a richer tribute to everyone that contributed to Trace because for the podcast, a lot was stripped out. A lot of detail was stripped out. The producer just wanted plot. So completely plot driven. And so he read the book and he's like, oh, I didn't know Ron used to be a truck driver.
Yeah.
I'm like, you would have bloody taken it out. And he said, yeah, I would have, but it's interesting. And I'm like, I know it's interesting. That's, you know. So we had this friction the whole way along. They wanted plot. I wanted richness of like S-Town. And so it was just stripped bare. So that's why it was cathartic to write the book, because I could put a lot of that in. A lot of the victims that only got a couple of grabs in the podcast, you could find out more about them. So it pays a richer tribute to, I think, everyone.
Yeah, absolutely, because there are a lot of characters. And also when you're listening to a podcast, I think it becomes difficult to follow when there are too many characters, whereas in a book you can retain more information when you're reading it.
Yeah.
So I think that was probably a good idea, The podcast, I can't believe how many things people came forward to say, I knew a guy when I was younger. He was a scary guy. He said this, he said that.
Yeah.
Even Phil Cleary's story becomes part of it.
Mm-hmm.
What was the most surprising thing that came up for you while you were making?
The bungle. Like, I hadn't counted on that. That came out of nowhere when I learnt about that. And that was what was one of the most upsetting things, because I thought, well, I wanted to give the boys the James brothers an answer.
When did that come up for you? Because I remember talking to Ron Idles about this case, and it must be 3 years ago, because it's a famous case whenever you're talking to or about Ron, because it's his first case as a homicide detective and it was unsolved. So given his incredible track record, that was always a thing that you talked to Ron about. And I remember saying to Ron at the time, oh, I'm spewing that DNA cleared Father Bongiorno, because I was sure it was him.
Yeah.
And he said then, well, you know, I'm not too sure about that.
Well, I had the same conversation with him before we even started Trace. So when I was investigating, prepping it, and he was what I thought is, how do you reconcile that? The police won't say they got Bongiorno's DNA or if they got it, how they got it. But two people said to me that they heard that Bongiorno was ruled out on the basis of DNA. So how does that happen? And yet a witness has seen him covered in blood at the time of the murder, and that witness's testimony has never seen the light of day. So I couldn't reconcile those two things. The family has never been able to, and Ron's never been able to. So I went into Trace, and I probably didn't find out about the bungle until I can't say when, as in I remember, but I can't tell you when, but it was around the launch.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it was only actually made
so
public.
So it was either like between a month before and a month after the launch, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So is that maybe a year ago?
Yeah.
Maybe a year ago it was revealed officially that.
Well, no, the cops didn't reveal it until July. July, because I put to them, can you confirm or deny by Tuesday 5 p.m.?
Okay.
And the deadline passed, and then at 6 p.m. Mark called and said, oh, the cops have just left. They've been in my lounge room and they've told me that there was a bungle.
That there was a pillow slip.
So that was in July last year.
A pillow slip that was in an evidence bag that was marked as being from the scene of the crime that was actually from a different
different crime scene. I think it was from a 1975 homicide. But I also don't know whether that affected that case.
Yeah.
That missing pillow from that case. I'm not sure.
I'm shocked as well at the Victoria Police's disinterest still. I mean, even in the episode that's dropped this week, you're talking about some evidence that you have had in your possession that potentially had DNA on it.
Yeah.
And that you offered it to Victoria Police and they didn't want it.
Yeah, I think I've tried to put myself in the officer's shoes. So the officer that I offered it to said, well, there's nothing to compare it to. You know, because of the bungle, there's no primary DNA source. So even if you give us this magazine, which might have the killer's blood on it, there's nothing to compare it to. And I said, yeah, but there might be later. Like, just keep it for later, just in case you find new stuff. Or if you test the twine that was around her wrists, you know, maybe that will yield something and you can compare it to the magazine. But that's not, they don't store stuff just in case.
Okay.
And that was their line. And he said to me, it's like us collecting all the cigarette butts on the ground just in case they've got a killer's DNA on it. And I said, well, That's a bit different. I'm giving you something that I know could potentially be helpful. But that was their line, that there's no primary sample, so nothing to compare it to. And I also think they had a problem with, and probably still will in the future, the continuity of evidence.
Yes.
So that magazine, a book dealer got it from the store 17 years after the murder.
Wow.
So that's a problem. You know, like had he got in and taken it that night, that would have been better. But 17 years after, it's a long time. He did take it from the shop, so I suspect it's just been sitting around all that time in a spare room perhaps. But then he's then kept it at his house. So I fear that they'll say, we can't really touch that because of the continuity of evidence, won't hold up in court. But it might hold up in a coronial inquest where the bar is, it's a lower bar, it's probability, not beyond reasonable doubt.
But you took that magazine to Adelaide to a lab and it tested positive, right, for DNA matching the brother of a person of interest in your investigation.
Sure. So I should go into this because it's really important that this is clear. So between you and I, we share most of our DNA. And there are
Do we?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I didn't know that.
Adrian Lineker, who's a professor at Flinders University in Adelaide, said it's really humans are a strange species because we share most of our DNA. But there are little bits that are different. So it's like a book. There might be one sentence in the whole book that's different.
Yes. I remember him saying that, yes.
So it's about how do you find that sentence? So there are 24 different regions that scientists can test that are different from person to person. There might be more, but they're untestable. So they've got a kit that tests 24 regions. So I took the magazine and I also took something else that someone gave me, which is I'll call an item, which might have DNA on it from Father O'Keefe's twin brother. Now, Father O'Keefe was one of the priests that Adam James says molested him.
Mm-hmm.
So that potentially gives a pedophilia motive. And being a twin, being a brother, they share genetic material. So I thought, well, if I have this sample, maybe I should compare it to the magazine. That's very kind of CSI. Mm-hmm. As Adrian puts it, Adrian Lineker, he said, people think it's easy. You've got something with blood on it. Great, we'll get DNA. Apparently it's not that easy. That you might have a blood stain, but it might be old or bacteria might have broken it up and you can't get DNA out of it. So here I went, you know, full steam ahead thinking, well, I've got the sample, so I'll get DNA. And then when I got there and he was doing all the testing that you'll hear in episode 7, trying to first ascertain that it was blood, you know, and some tests weren't even showing that because it was so old. And I thought, oh, God, you know, well, this has been a wasted expedition. It's incredibly complicated and he's got $250,000 machine to analyse those 24 regions. So thankfully he was able to ascertain, yes, there was blood on the magazine. Yes, there was blood and a hair sample on the item that belonged to Father O'Keefe's twin brother.
Dying to know what the item is, by the way. I was listening to that bit.
I'm sworn to secrecy, I'm sorry.
But I was listening to that bit. I'm trying to figure out what on earth is this item that could reveal who the identity of the brother that has hair on it and blood. It's fascinating.
The friend of the family that brought it to me, I've promised that I'll protect their identity. Mm. So we ascertained that they had DNA on both of them. And so here's the interesting bit. So of those 24 regions, 5 regions showed up in the magazine.
Mm-hmm.
11 regions showed up in the hair sample.
Mm.
And the four out of 5 from the magazine matched the corresponding 4 regions in the hair sample.
Okay.
So 4 unique DNA regions on the magazine matched 4 unique DNA regions of the O'Keefe family. So it certainly doesn't definitively say Father O'Keefe was the killer. I'm certainly not saying that. But I don't think he should be ruled out as a person of interest.
Okay. Also, the was it the electrician back at the church?
Yeah.
It was Father Bongiorno that he says that he saw come back that afternoon.
Correct.
With blood on his face and on his sleeve and on his arm.
So he said he saw the priest with blood on his face, on his hands and on one arm, and it was sleeve was rolled up. And Alan Herco, the electrician, says he said that he'd go and get a first aid kit. The priest disappeared. And the next he heard was yelling inside the presbytery and it, a woman yelling in Italian at the priest.
Oh, this was the housekeeper.
Mm, well, I think maybe she was just a woman who cooked for him or cleaned for him. I'm still trying to find her. So if anyone knows who someone who was helping out at the presbytery in 1980, please contact me because that I really need to find her if she's still alive.
Mm.
But yes, Father Buongiorno was the one seen covered in blood. But I kind of looked at this theory in episode 3, just because he had blood on him doesn't make him a killer. Perhaps he was near her when she was stabbed. Perhaps he found her and went to help. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, let's hypothesize and think, well, what if Maria James called the presbytery and actually got in touch with Father O'Keefe instead because he was the parish priest? What if it was Father O'Keefe that came for the meeting mm-hmm. or interrupted the meeting
mm-hmm.
with Father Buongiorno? So there's nothing to say that two priests weren't there at the time
sure.
of the murder.
Because the theory that if we go with the theory that's most obvious, it is that her poor son Adam, who has disabilities, he has Tourette's and
cerebral palsy,
told her the day before or told her very close to that day that Father Buongiorno had been molesting him.
Mm.
She said to Adam, I'm going to call him and sort it out.
Yeah.
And she told him that on that morning, I'm going to call him today and sort it out.
That's right.
And she sent both boys off to school.
Mm.
And she went and bought a cake on her way home. And then when she was found, there were two coffee cups.
Correct.
On the counter. And then we have the story. I mean, also the creepiest part of the story is that she was on the phone to her ex-husband.
Yeah.
And he heard what he said, sort of startled yelps, but he said they weren't like screams. They weren't terrified screams. They were startled yelps. And he heard her talking, but he couldn't make out what she was saying. So he did think, though, I'm going to go around there and see what's happening. And by the time he got there, she was dead. Yeah. He found her body inside.
I think about that conversation a lot, and I just think if only he'd heard a name, you know, it could have been so – or what if he got there a couple of minutes earlier? Could have been so different.
Well, also he could have been killed, though.
He could have been.
I mean – Ron Idles, the detective in charge of the investigation, certainly believes that the killer was still in the house when he got there. He believes he was hiding behind the bedroom door.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a terrifying thought. Ron's money still remains on Father Buongiorno. He says he's got a strong motive. He was seen after the murder covered in blood. That to him is a stronger kind of scenario than Father O'Keefe being the killer.
When the husband arrived, the front door was locked, so he went around the back and gained access. And then when he went back around the front door was suddenly open, and there was a lady inside looking around at the books. And a man had run out the front door and was almost hit by a car. What was the description given by the person driving that car? Did it match Father Buongiorno?
No, and there was talk about a shirt, like a white shirt, and if that's the case, surely it would have had blood specks on it. And then a woman that called up John Fain's program on ABC Radio after episode 2 said she'd seen Father Buongiorno standing in front of the bookshop, and I thought she said in a black shirt, you know, that typical priest shirt with a collar. So, and I wanted to stress through the podcast too, I mean, this is what I've been able to find out. But there are 10 cold case boxes that belong to Maria James in a storehouse in Laverton that might have compelling motives that I don't know about. Phil Cleary, victim's advocate, he says it could be Peter Keogh. Now, Peter Keogh is a man who killed Phil Cleary's sister, Vicky Cleary.
Mm-hmm.
Peter Keogh says that someone in a pub once heard Peter Keogh say, "I'll do to you what I did to the woman in the bookshop." So in today's episode, in episode 7, I also go and interview a woman called Cheryl who used to know Keogh. So she says, yes, I think Keogh was dating Maria. And after after the murder, he didn't want to go anywhere near the bookshop. He avoided it like the plague. He said, I can't go near there. It's too hot, as in police are hot on my tail. And then she said he went underground for 3 months and they didn't see him. So there's so many kind of interesting elements about this case. So you've got Keogh, there's a real estate agent that she was seeing soon up until her murder, and she found out he was married. So she broke it off with him. He had an alibi, another real estate agent, but I'm not sure whether cops have ever gone back to that alibi to see whether that's changed. There was a Telstra worker who committed suicide shortly after he was interviewed by the homicide squad. So I want to stress, we are talking about a lot of people, and I've been careful not to point the finger, I don't think, at anyone, because I want people to understand if this ever makes court, I would hate for a defence lawyer to say, well, Trace said it's not my guy. So, mm-hmm. you know, I don't want to be responsible for jeopardising the chances of the James brothers getting justice.
Mm. After the break, we talk about what to expect from the inquest. Coming up on Australian True Crime, Rachel recalls the promise she made to Maria James. So why do you think the coroner has decided to investigate again?
It was actually really humbling and heartening to read his reasons, which I have here for you today if you'd like them. Mm. And they do read like a log of the podcast Bombshells. You know, the first inquest was done in 1982 by Coroner Ken Mason, and he had no idea about, because no one did, you know, that Adam had been abused by not one priest but two priests.
No, that Adam only talked about that in 2013,
correct,
didn't he?
That's incredible. So that wasn't known, and that's huge. Mm. So that's a big one. So the coroner will be looking at and hopefully interviewing Adam James about his abuse by Father Bongiorno and Father O'Keefe.
Mm.
There's questions about Father Bongiorno's alibi. He was a man by the name of Father Sean O'Connell. Another victim I interviewed, Rex, says that Father O'Connell is not trustworthy, that O'Connell paid him money once that he thought that this victim, Rex, thought was hush money. So they'll look at Father Bongiorno's alibi, and then they'll look at evidence, the DNA bungle, missing documents, documents that aren't accessible under freedom of information. So it's quite a wide-ranging scope. The coroner, acting state coroner, says he'll be looking at both the Catholic Church and Victoria Police.
Mm. I mean, is there any suggestion? I know I've heard before that in the old days, certainly leading right up into the 80s, that the police force was sort of had two factions, the Masons and the Catholics,
mm.
and that depending on who was the head of police at the time, that was the dominant faction. Is there any suggestion that there was a cover-up at the time by the Catholic faction of the police force?
I did look into that, and I interviewed a man by the name of Dennis Ryan, who you might remember. He's up in Mildura, and he was ostracised from the Victorian police force because he took on a paedophile priest, and he was basically hounded from the force because certain elements of his chain of command were protecting priests at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So I told him the story. I said, look, do you think this could be the case here? Could it be Catholic mafia involvement? And he said, to his credit, Rach, I'm not a man to speculate, but I have seen that they are capable of lots of heinous things. He said, I don't know whether that would extend to murder or protecting priests suspected of murder,
mm.
but he said, I have seen them do a lot of things that surprise me. So I'm not sure. At the start, I thought human error, you always kind of lean towards cock up over conspiracy. But then more things went missing and more things didn't add up. And so now I'm really not sure. So I've been trying to look into every avenue.
Also, Adam hadn't spoken at that point about the fact that he had been molested by priests.
Mm.
But it's interesting that it was a family friend who first raised the alarm about that, wasn't it, who came?
That's really interesting. Yeah. So she said to Mark one day, have you ever asked Adam?
Mm.
She asked Mark, she said, have you been abused by Bongiorno?
Mm.
And what about Adam? And Mark thought, well, that's ridiculous. But he promised her that he would ask Adam. So he did, just to rule a line under it. And Mark, do you know, Friday was the second time I saw Mark cry, but this is the only time that I've ever seen Mark James cry,
mm.
is when he repeated that story to me and said that he asked Adam in the car, and Adam just said, nodded. And said, yes, he did. And I told Mum. And Mark just says, I burst into tears in the car.
It's incredibly sad. Yeah. And it made me wonder what Adam's been thinking about that all those years. Has Adam been holding himself responsible? Has he been wondering
mm.
if that's what happened? Has he ever spoken about that?
I did ask him that, and it's a horrible thing to ask, because it sounds like I'm suggesting he should be, and I certainly don't think he should feel guilty. But I said, Adam, do you, like, why did you keep it to yourself? Was it, did you feel ashamed or guilty because the last time you told someone, she was killed?
Yes.
And he, basically, it was out of fear, he says, because, and this broke my heart, when he came forward in 2013, he was still terrified. Father Buongiorno had been dead a decade and he didn't even know.
So he didn't know Buongiorno was dead.
No. So it was simply out of fear that he'd kept quiet for so long because these both these priests had said, Adam, you can trust me. Don't ever tell anyone about this.
Also in episode 7, you have another victim who talks about Buongiorno saying that he had big friends who would take care of them if they said anything. Yeah. So I guess even if you felt that Buongiorno was out of the picture, who knows who these friends are.
And I'd love to say more on that, but I can't, other than that they were powerful connections. But yeah, he just said, oh, my friend will sort it out if, you know, if you ever tell anyone.
So do you think Adam will testify in the inquest?
Yeah, I do. I think and Ron expects the electrician to be called, Adam to be called. I would love some of the confidants of Father Buongiorno to be called. I'm not sure whether I can allow to put in a wish list, but that would be mine. People that he might have spoken to in confidence. This is the thing, though. Under canon law, we could put those priests in the box, and I don't think they're – well, what do you think?
Are they compelled to testify?
Exactly.
I don't think they are they?
I thought state law would be higher than canon law, but recently we've seen that that's not the case.
Will you be asked to testify?
Someone asked me that yesterday. I hadn't even thought of it. I'm not sure. A really humbling moment for me was when I saw my name in the decisions. So they quote, the coroner quotes a lot of my material. So perhaps, I think, but I mean, they've heard it all through Trace, but perhaps, and I'd be happy to talk. It was just, Michelle, it was just such a momentous thing on Friday. Like, this has been nearly 3 years for me. And yeah. I spoke to you on radio when we first launched Trace, and I'd been at that stage working on it for a year and a half. So this is big, and this has taken over most of my life. And to sit in front of those boys on Friday, you know, when they were crying and saying thanks to Ron Idles and thanks to Trace and thanks to the ABC. Sorry, I'm getting emotional now. And Adam said, and I want to thank my friend Rach. You know, I lost it. It was just because I just thought, wow, this is why many of us get into journalism in the first place. You rarely get to affect change, even though you think you will, because the news day just becomes this grind. It rarely happens. And to be part of something that's made a real change to this family, I'm so proud of it. I'm so damn proud of it.
It was emotional to listen to for me this last episode, and even for Ron to think about, you know, getting some resolution for him in this case. It's wonderful to see such an achievement, and it's not finished yet.
No.
And to give hope to a family that's been waiting for such a long time.
And as Mark put it really eloquently too, he said, not just our family, but hopefully this gives hope to other families. Maybe other cold cases would be looked at. It gives hope to other victims of sexual abuse. Like, they watch Adam and see his bravery in coming forward, and perhaps through him they'll be given a voice. The community, I want to thank, they have been phenomenal. You know, for a story that's so dark, and I used to do court stories and read, you know, hear about all the depravity and violence. And back then I had quite a kind of dim view of humanity. And this story as well is quite dark, but there's been so much light and hope and beauty in Trace in terms of the amazing audience mobilization and this community force, such a precious force, and people that came out with new leads, but also support for the James family, you know, just to say, good on you, keep going, or, oh, I used to teach Mark, can you put me back in touch with him? That, I just think what we could potentially do with that, maybe with other cases, is incredible. And to have such support for such an important story, and I think I've been careful the whole way along. You know, I did it forensically. I've done it compassionately. I never treated it like entertainment.
No.
And I've been personally happy with how that's resonated with people.
You know, for me, it was a moment in the second episode when, and I always talk about this with Teacher's Pet, there's a certain moment in that series that just gets me. And for this series, there's a moment when you talk about Adam telling his mum, and you say, you know, when he told Mark what had happened to him, it was only the second time he'd told anyone, and the only other person he'd ever told, and I said it with you, was his mum. And I just visualise myself and my son, and I feel the fury, I feel the protectiveness, I feel in her the, you know, tiger mother, yeah. I have to put a stop to this. Don't worry, I'm going to stop this. I'm going to fix this. Mm. You go to school, I'm going to fix this, you know.
Yeah.
And the fact that whatever happened, she was defeated, it just boils my blood.
Yeah. I do wonder whether that protectiveness killed her.
Me too. Me too. And that kills me that, you know, that she wasn't able to in the end, and that she was defeated. So, yeah, that's why it's so powerful to me.
And I hope too that through Trace her spirit isn't.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
And she was stubborn. I'm stubborn.
Yeah.
In case you hadn't got that by now. Mm. Ron's stubborn.
Yeah.
Mark's stubborn. Like, that's really something that I think has shone through this podcast, the doggedness.
Yeah.
Of trying to get answers for this woman.
And this community saying, you're not in this alone.
Yeah.
You know, we're all going to help you finish this and end this.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's beautiful. Congratulations. It's so wonderful to feel like we're all part of it as listeners.
Thank
we're
you.
Part of this campaign.
Thank you. Yeah. I really hope. And for people that haven't heard it, I hope they go back and listen to this like compelling investigation. But there will be more. I'm obviously still working on new leads coming in, and there'll of course be updates when the inquest happens.
And another series. I was stunned. I thought, I can't believe you're doing this again.
I am gonna have a little break.
Yes.
Over Christmas.
But I need can a rest. You tell us anything about the second series?
Only that I'm choosing between two at the moment.
Oh.
I really want to work with Vic Pohl this time, even just a little bit. You know,
yep.
So if I can see which case they're more amenable to working on, I mean, maybe I'm idealistic and it won't happen. But I really want to choose something that is solvable,
mm-hmm.
And that perhaps they could send targeted call outs, you know, about maybe don't waste your time on the blue car, but it's the woman with the green hair we need to find, or, you know,
sure.
Because we need to tap into that huge power of the audience, and they know I always said I'm not going to solve it, but perhaps it could be solved through me by other people coming forward and
yeah.
then helping law organisations to do their job.
I found that really interesting when Ron was saying in episode 7 that he thinks that Vic Pohl's become too insular and they're not embracing podcasting, and they should. Just last week I was in there at HQ and I was talking to Commander Stuart Bateson about South Sudanese
yeah.
crime. We had a fantastic conversation. We've had such great feedback, and he and his media advisor were saying to me, we want to do more of this.
Yeah.
We want to do more. Please, you know, let's keep talking. So I think, you know, there is definitely an element within the organisation that's really positive and really wants to do more.
Completely. And I've spoken about him to him with similar things before.
Great.
And there is a force within Victoria Police that we've got to move with the times.
Mm-hmm.
But isn't it interesting that when Ron started at Homicide, he was 25, they were working on typewriters,
yeah.
writing on carbon paper.
Yeah.
There's beautiful old shots of them all with their mustaches and brown little suits sitting around a dining table.
Yeah.
It was pure boot leather, you know. And we've gone from that to an era where there's this innovative thing called podcasting, when people can just call up and say, oh, my friend told me this once at the pub.
Yeah.
You know, I think Ron's been quite amazed by that.
Yeah.
He's always
been an innovator though, hasn't he?
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. And compassionate too, which I want to come back to. But he says, you know, these things, awards, they used to work. They're not really working so much anymore.
Mm.
The 10-second news grab on 7 p.m. news, it doesn't work anymore. People aren't home to watch it. You need to be thinking broader. And can I just say the biggest thanks to Ron Idles. He has been one of the most beautiful human beings I've ever got the opportunity to work with.
Yeah.
And I feel so lucky. I mean, his compassion, I think, clearly shows through the podcast, but he just never forgets families, and he still, you know, he still takes, he's supposed to be retired.
Yeah.
Well, from detective work, he takes every call. He still does, you know, he still lets people send a camera up to wherever he's living now in North Queensland to do interviews, because he genuinely believes in helping families.
Yeah. Yeah, that's why he said he'll never change his mobile number.
Yeah.
His mobile number is still on websites, various websites, yeah, you know, for unsolved cases. And he knows that he is still the person some people will call, and he couldn't bear for that call to go unanswered because he's retired and changed his number. Yeah.
And he must be exhausted. I don't know how. I mean, I'm exhausted and this has been, 3 years. He must be exhausted, but he just genuinely believes, and particularly with the Murray James case, there is someone. Killers tell people.
Yeah.
So there is someone out there that knows who killed Murray James. And so it's just getting to that person. So I think he feels like if he keeps making himself accessible, we might solve more crimes. And isn't that a beautiful thing? Mm. Like, what a beautiful human being.
Yeah. As are you, my friend. Well
done.
Thank
you. Thank you very much.
Done. Congratulations. Thank you so much for downloading this episode of Australian True Crime. We'll be taking a short break. You've got all of Trace to listen to, perhaps. Don't forget to download the book. I downloaded it for my Kindle, or buy a hard copy of the book, Trace. It's excellent. Even if you've heard all the episodes 2 or 3 times, the book is still an excellent buy. It has lots of extra information and just extra nuance. It's so great. So do that. Or you can also go to, or not or, and also go to patreon.com/AustTrueCrimePod, AUST, True Crime Pod, because all of our patrons will be getting content all over Christmas as well. So Merry Christmas to everybody, and we'll be back for everybody on the 24th of January.